times their preferred forests come together, and you can have them in close proximity.
That's the way it is. My acreage is 30 acres, and when I first heard it, it was at the end of my meadow before sundown, but I couldn't see it naturally. But then a few weeks later, I heard this one about 2 miles down the road and across a meadow. Could it have been the same one or a different, the great horn?
Well, they'll sometimes duet, so you could hear husband and wife calling each other.
Oh, well, that's
I
got my Audubon book out, and I said, well, it's got to be one of those. I know it's not a snowy owl. It's not a screech owl. And so for this part of Texas, I'm happy. Maybe it will come in my yard.
Yeah, and then there in deep east Texas, there's a third very common species of owl that's tiny. It's about the size of a 12-ounce soda can. It's the eastern screech owl. It doesn't make a screech sound. It makes a kind of a whistle with a whinny to it. Let me see if I can do it.
Right.
Yep, that's the eastern screech owl. So, so I just did all three of the more common owls in the listening area, especially in deep east Texas. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Louise.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call concerning questions about birds or our avian world or how to protect our wildlife in this area, Cliff can handle those. So give us a call right now, again, at 800-552-8502. Now, coming up in December is your 115th annual Christmas bird count. Can you tell us more about this count and how folks can participate?
Well, what's really interesting is that it's the longest-running citizen science program in the world, on the planet, which is pretty neat. And what I mean by citizen scientists are those people that go out. They don't necessarily have training in this field or degrees, but they're willing to go out and they're counting birds. And so what's really neat is we have, over a century worth of data. And what we can do, especially for the counts that are they're static, they don't move. These places we count birds, they don't move, but the birds can change, and we can see that because we cover this same area, this what we call a Christmas bird count circle. And if you do that circle for say 40 winters, you can really see the ups and downs of birds. And in our area, you can see things like when there's an invasion of purple finches or an invasion of red-breasted nuthatch. Those are birds that are fairly cyclical or what we call eruptive, and they might not be here every year. But we can also see numbers of things going up or down. We might notice that ring-billed gull is a bird on the increase. So it's really fantastic with a Christmas bird count to see the trend over time. It's trend data that these citizen scientists are collecting. So if you're interested, there are several Christmas counts in this listening area and all over the country. Just Google it. Just Google Christmas bird count and the state that you live in, and that'll eventually get you to your area where you can find out who the compiler is. There's always going to be a chief, a compiler, and that person, he or she, is going to work with you on giving you an area to cover or putting you with a team. If you're a beginner, you might not want your own area. You might say, hey, I'm new at this, and they'll put you with a seasoned veteran that you might end up going out with, and boy, you're going to learn a lot from those folks.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is with the Texas Park and Wildlife Department, and he is here to answer your questions tonight. Anything about birding and our wildlife community, you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We did have somebody who called in earlier. They didn't want to go on the air, but they did leave us a question. And it's Martin from Lufkin. And what he asked is, do cardinals in the South group in more than one pair, male and female? He claims he only saw one pair at a time when living in Chicago.
Well, I think what happened was it was probably different seasons. And so, yes, in the breeding season, they're going to be just a pair monitoring and defending a territory. But what we see with cardinals in the wintertime is they'll get into big flocks. And I've seen some that are, I've seen some shrubs with 25 male cardinals in it, and females as well in there in the group. So you can sometimes come across a flock of 40 plus cardinals at a time, and that's in the winter time. They're safety with number. They're not territorial at that time, and they're just probably working more as a team to stay fit through the winter months. But what happens when the days get longer and it's springtime and food is more generous and available, they will start separating out into male and female pair and go through the breeding cycle. So what I think happened in Chicago, we probably did that in the summertime and didn't notice what they do in the winter. And there is some movement in a lot of these birds that we think stay year-round, like our mockingbirds do some short-range migration, red-headed woodpeckers as well. So a lot of these birds are moving around. It doesn't mean they go from the U.S. to Guatemala, but they might go from, you know, North Texas to South Texas. So short-range movement, or even maybe just a couple counties. So the cardinals will get in big groups, big flocks in the colder months, and it's fantastic to see that. And let me give you a little tip or trick. Bird watchers do what's called pishing, and it sounds like this. And if you do that for when you see a couple of cardinals, it's kind of a universal scold that something's wrong. Like there might be a cat or an owl or a hawk nearby, and they all want to get involved and kind of oust or mob the predator. So it's a way for bird watchers to see all these skulking birds, and all these cardinals might be hiding. Well, if you start pishing, they'll hop up and kind of sprinkle that tree, like the one I mentioned earlier, where it just looks like Christmas ornaments, all those cardinals on that one shrub where I said I had a couple dozen. So that pishing is a good tip or a trick that bird watchers use to get birds to come up. Doesn't work on everything, but it works with wrens, a lot of sparrows. It'll work on, again, the cardinal and the things that are kind of low in the thicket. So it's probably not going to work. It's not going to work on a crow or a duck. So I think it's pretty obvious it's going to work for thicket-loving birds.
You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and he's here to take your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have all lines open right now, so feel free to call in. Again, the number is 800-552-8502. Now, right now is the migratory season for quite a few birds. It's the beginning part of it for some and probably the middle part for others. Hummingbirds have been migrating here for a little while now, have they not? And where are we at in this season?
Well, the hummingbirds are a good topic because we are in the mild south in this listening area, and you can get lucky and host a wintering hummingbird, but you're gonna need to be ready, have your feeder out, and keep it maintained. You don't need to change it out as much as you do in the hot summer when that nectar gets a little stale and stagnant, but it'll keep a lot better in the cool weather. But if we didn't put feeders out, these vagrant or overwintering hummingbirds wouldn't have much to live on. They do well with Turk's cap that they kind of keep for a while. Shrimp plant might keep for a while in the cold snaps. But a buddy of mine just sent me a text the other day. He said, I have a copper colored hummingbird. He knew what it was, a rufous hummingbird. And Jeff Reed in Lufkin. And so Jeff got on it. He made sure they put a feeder up and has a good time watching that bird. And hopefully it'll stick around. There's no way to know if it's going to stick around. But this is the time when you can get one of those shiny copper penny hummingbirds if you're ready and you're paying attention and you're lucky. All those stars have to align. And the rufous hummingbird is quite the treat.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we'd love to take your calls right now. We do have a caller online, and we're going to go to that next. This is Jill from Marshall, Texas. Jill, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Thank you so much. I love the program and really enjoy all the good information that you provide for us.
Great. Thank you, Jill.
Yeah. My question involves suddenly having no birds in our backyard, which really concerns me. We always have a profuse number of cardinals, blue jays, mourning doves, And I do put food out, same bird seed, I've never changed it, in the bird feeder, and also put it on the ground for the mourning doves and the other. And in the last, I'd say, 3 to 4 weeks, it's almost like a graveyard out there, and it concerns me, and I don't know why we're not getting any birds.
And the sky is falling. Well, I can tell you that the sky is not falling, and I'll mention this again. We talked about in the first 5 minutes of the show that this is a common call that we get in the fall at Parks and Wildlife. Is that where are the birds? And so I mentioned it earlier. I'll just reiterate real quick that Mother Nature has been good to the birds this year. We had a lot of rain, and a lot of the berry and nut and insect-producing plants are giving birds home cooking, and they'd rather eat what Mother Nature's providing than the seeds. So I tell people to just be patient. That don't gauge the use of your feeder by the bird life. Just wait a while; they'll come back.
That's good news.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Or you can email us tonight if you prefer to email your question, or if you have a photograph to send us, you can send that to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. There's no spaces between any of the words there, so just write it all out like an email address. And what we want to do next is there's other birds that are southbound at this time, too. Can you give us kind of a list of what we might see transpire through and, and trespass through the area?
Well, what's neat about this time of the year in the listening area is that we're on the receiving end of a lot of northern birds, where they breed up in Canada or northern the U.S., northern parts of the U.S., but they come here to overwinter. We're pretty mild. Relatively, although it didn't feel very mild last night, did it? Well, it is mild, and so we receive a lot of sparrows in the wintertime, you know, two dozen or more in Texas over winter with us. A lot of waterfowl over winter with us, so it's a great time of the year to see birds that we don't see in the breeding season that come down and spend the winter with us.
Give us an idea of some of the waterfowl, because there's some beautiful birds within that kind of genre of avian life. I mean, big, you know, beautiful blue herons and snowy egrets and the like. What will we see in this part of the country?
Yeah, and so waterfowl refers to ducks, geese, swans, and herons and egrets are water birds, colonial water birds. So, but all of them need water, and the good thing is, I like to tell people, if they want to start bird watching, find a lake or a pond, because birds that occur around lakes and ponds are typically larger and easier to see. You don't want to start off with sparrows. That'll turn anybody off to birds on the first day. It's very difficult. They're small. They're skulking. Whereas ducks are out on the water. They're easy. And what you want to do is also try to avoid the city parks where there are the bread-eating, mongrel, domesticated varieties. You'll see a lot of muscovies and mallards, and white mallards that never leave. But what we're talking about is look for the birds that are truly wild stock that come down here. And there's probably close to two dozen species of ducks and geese that come into the listening area at this time of the year. And we do have a few of the herons that will stay into the winter. You will get great blues and great egrets will overwinter with us. It's a tough time for like green herons. They pretty much all leave. We don't have many winter records of green herons. They don't like it cold, but great blue herons do very well. A lot of people call them blue cranes. I read a new colloquial name for that one. It's not new. It's new for me, but big cranky. And I thought that was a great name. And if you've ever flushed or spooked a great blue heron, they kind of make a and it's kind of this groaning, moaning sound, and it does sound like someone who's cranky. So, and I really love the colloquial names where they're named after something that's real and tangible like that. You know, otherwise you look for a great blue heron, that, you know, there's not really a whole lot of blue.
Right,
it's kind of a gray blue. I see it, but it's not like a sky blue. or you know, the Caribbean water blue.
Right.
But the Big Cranky, I think, is a great name. And now I can't stop thinking about that, especially when I see one flying off. And if I get to hear him moaning and groaning, I think, oh, that's a great name, Big Cranky.
And if you actually want to see what a great blue heron looks like, we have a photograph on our website our last show. I was up in the Ozarks.
And you took that picture.
In September, yeah. And I caught one along the Buffalo River up in the middle of the Ozarks. I was doing a little hiking back mm-hmm. there with my camera and saw him on the other side of the river on a rock and got a nice shot of him on the rock. But then he took off just as I had the focus and everything ready and actually caught him in flight. So it was quite beautiful.
Yeah.
And they are beautiful birds. Now, how about like sandhill cranes? Do they come down as well?
Yeah, sandhill crane is not really common in this listening area. They like to skirt around us. The biggest numbers are going to be just to the west of the listening area. You really have to go west of the Trinity River to really pick up big numbers. And if you live like when I lived in Austin, I-35 corridor, that's where the mother lode is going north and south. They're wintering in South Texas. There are a whole bunch that winter in the Panhandle and South Plains of Texas. If you've never seen sandhill cranes getting huge numbers, it's amazing. And then the biggest ever, in my opinion, is Grand Island, Nebraska. And I did that, or Grand Isle, Nebraska. Is it Grand Isle or Grand Island? I can't remember. But it was near Kearney, Nebraska. And the sandhill cranes getting such huge numbers and lots of ducks and geese, and it is the most amazing spectacle I've ever seen as far as just sheer numbers of these water birds and waterfowl getting together. And the best time of the year to do that is, let's see, I did that in February a few years ago, and that was spectacular. But yeah, we just don't have a whole lot of sandhill cranes. I mean, they're here in small numbers, but nothing like west of here is where the big flow of sandhills are.
So do they winter down here, or do they also winter up in, I mean, February in Nebraska is quite cold lot of sandhills.
Right, and those birds are a mix of birds that have already come back. They've wintered somewhere else, and they're already heading north. I think a few of them are staying there, but I think a majority of them are already coming back, and they're going through those the farmland there, fattening up. It is very cold, but there's a lot of food.
Right. Yeah.
And then the Platte River is where they're going to roost, and that's where I went. There are some Audubon bird blinds that are specific for that, that there's probably a big, long waiting list to reserve one of those, where they actually put 20 or 30 people in those blinds, and you're very quiet, and you watch all these birds come into roost on the Platte River, and it is spectacular. It's really neat.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and he is from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, where he serves as their statewide non-game ornithologist. He is here to take your calls tonight at 800-552-8502, and we have all lines open right now. That's 800-552-8502, or if you would like to email a question, you can send that to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Again, that's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. And we do have an online question, and this was, what should this person do when a hawk takes up residence in their backyard? The hawk is scaring away a lot of the smaller wildlife.
Yeah, the hawks have to eat too. Guess what? They're carnivorous, and they're not going to switch their diets to the seeds or sticks or leaves. They're not going to eat in the acorns. So you just, if you're worried that your bird feeder, which can be like Grand Central Station with activity, and let me tell you, when you're a hawk and you eat birds, you see that. You notice Grand Central Station. So you might make sure you consider that when you put your feeder out. In other words, make sure that it's not too close to the window, because that's a big cause of bird death, is if your feeder's too close to the window. Here comes a blue darter, which is a colloquial name for the accipiters like sharpshin and Cooper's hawk. So here comes a Cooper's hawk scaring the little bird. He flies away, doesn't remember that there's a window. He's flying the opposite direction of the Cooper's hawk coming in. He hits the window to his death. The hawk's not going to eat it. The bird is dead. It's no good. So make sure your placement of your feeder is important. So what I'd say to the caller is enjoy the hawk, because that doesn't mean that Grand Central Station will quiet down. The smart birds are going to hide. The ones that are going to become lunch are, you know, probably the ones that aren't paying attention are going to become lunch, and that those are the ones maybe need to get culled out of the flock. So I'd say watch the hawk, enjoy it, and that's a National Geographic moment. And don't expect that bird, that raptor, to be there all day, every day. They'll move on.
I had the experience back in the 80s of seeing a peregrine falcon land and nest on a building across from where I worked. So we set up a camera and watched the entire process from the egg being laid literally to the hatching and the growth of two siblings in the nest until they finally took flight. We got it all on film, and it was absolutely a National Geographic moment. As a matter of fact, they came and grabbed a lot of that footage for their national TV show, because it was just so, I mean, it was so clear. It was right across the window, so all you had to do is set up a hidden camera in a dark room, and you know the birds wouldn't know the difference. And apparently they don't care that they're being spied on. So.
That's right. And I did remember it is Grand Island, Nebraska, because I was thinking of Louisiana as Grand Isle, Louisiana. Right. So anyway, I want to clear that up.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position that he's held since 1997. He is their statewide non-game ornithologist. He is here to take your questions about birds and our avian world, and you can give him a call right now at 800-552-8502. Again, that number is 800-552-8502. And we do have another online question, and that one is this person has not seen many hummingbird lately, hummingbirds, and they wanted to know, is it time to take their hummingbird feeder down?
Yeah, it's an old myth or old wives' tale to take your feeder down. That old wives' tale said that you had to take it down by Halloween or the hummingbirds would migrate. Well, let me tell you, these birds are hardwired to go when they're ready to go. Your feeder is not going to keep them here or make them mess up their own schedule. So we have the dominant hummingbird we have here is the ruby-throated hummingbird, and they really pour through the last half of September and into early October. And then as October progresses, which is now behind us, those ruby-throated hummingbirds are really gone. Those are migratory. Those guys are going to Mexico and points farther south. Mexico to Costa Rica is where the bulk of our ruby-throats go. And so they will be back, though, about the second, third week of March. Usually about the third week of March is when they return, about when the buckeyes start to send up those beautiful red tubular flowers, and it's probably well-timed with the hummingbird's return. So most of our ruby throats should be gone, if not all of them. So the ones that we sometimes host in the winter are usually western, more rocky mountain hummingbirds, like I mentioned the rufous a few minutes ago. That's a hardy bird of the Rocky Mountains. It can handle those nights that get chilly, even in the summertime, where it can get down in the 40s. That's not a problem, or even the 30s in the Rockies where they breed. And this temperature we have here is nothing for the rufous hummingbird. Another one is the broad-tailed hummingbird. There are a few records of that one as well. And that's another Rocky Mountain bird that's pretty hardy and can handle our south winters. Now, the ruby throat, they like to get out of here. And so what that person that emailed is probably responding to is they witnessed the southbound migration and mass exodus of our local ruby-throated hummingbirds. And they should be all gone now. If you've got one now, take a picture, look at it carefully, make sure it is a ruby throat, because if it's a male and the angle's just right, you might see a little flash of purple on the bottom of the throat, and you've got a black chinned. So make sure you really study your hummingbirds carefully. What I like to tell people to do is, A, keep your feeder up, and B, take a photograph of that hummingbird before you start calling people and telling them about it, because all of a sudden you're going to find that bird was only there for about 30 minutes and he's gone, he's done. So take the photograph, because then you documented it, and then you can float that around to experts and they can help you figure out what it was. And then that location and that date might be meaningful to somebody.
You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502, or you can email us at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. So now the idea of photographing them brings up a question that I have, and I love to go out and collect sound effects, which is a little easier because you can get further away from the birds. You can set up a tape recorder and just walk away and just let it go for an hour. But for bird shutterbugs, and unless you have a extremely high-powered zoom lens, which also makes your depth of field, you know, problematic, then how do you get close to birds to get a good shot of them?
Well, I've seen this transition in the birding community. You can really see it on the coast in spring migration that probably, I don't know, almost one in two or one in three bird watchers now are equipped with incredible cameras, with incredible lenses, and they're taking incredible photos. And they have this thing called Photoshop. And they can really, you know, tweak the colors and make things just right. And if there's all of a sudden a high line in the way, they can make that disappear. And they can really do a lot. The problem with the recordings, if you live close to humans, you're going to have airplanes flying by, traffic noise, dogs barking, chickens crowing. I mean, it's amazing how our airspace, if you tune in with your ears, is really interrupted by a lot of human created and human caused things that can really mess up your sound recording.
And here is a great example of that. And this was recorded in a fairly quiet neighborhood here in Shreveport. I mean, if you're just, you know, sitting out on your front porch, you think this is a very quiet neighborhood, but the ambient noise in the background is just extraordinary. So in the background, you can hear a European starling, but you hear all of the air around that. That's just air conditioning noise from local air conditioning units. And they, you know, you tune them out when you're listening with your ears. You almost like mentally filter that garbage out, but tape recorders, unfortunately, filter nothing.
Yeah, and where I really paid attention to this, outside of the bird recording arena, is with the film crew. And we have a really busy, productive film crew with Parks and Wildlife, and I just did an interview on film on Friday, a few days ago, down at Atwater Prairie Chicken Refuge near Seely, Texas, and we had to stop the interview every now and then because a big jet would fly over, and you don't think about it. He's, you know, 10, 20,000 feet up, but he took off from Intercontinental about an hour away. And when he flies right over you, it ruins the recording. So the video people really know about it too. And these microphones are just spectacular, picking up things that sometimes you don't want to hear. But the bird recording folks get what are called shotgun mics, and they can really focus in on the bird and try to eliminate all the other stuff. But it's getting tougher and tougher to find these wild places without these sounds that point to humans, and it's getting really tough.
And it used to be, you know, that you used a parabolic mic, but unfortunately, a parabolic mic actually grabs every sound that's coming at it, as opposed to a shotgun, which is like a telephoto lens.
That's right. And the parabolic, it also is clumsy, it's bulky, it's hard to crash through the woods with it. It's hard to carry it when you're not using it. It's just a mess, and nobody uses those anymore. Well, I don't say no. I shouldn't say nobody, but you're the hardcore people that want it compact are using the shotgun mics.
Right, yeah. So you are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502, and we have Tom from Ringgold. And Tom, what is your question? You're online with Cliff Shackelford tonight.
Yes, I was wondering if any of the schools or the wildlife people were interested in specimens if we happen to come up on something, you know, a roadkill in fairly decent shape. I know we used to collect them and record where they were killed and found and turn them into people and maybe you know, so that the schools could make skins out of them?
Yes. And usually those are going to be higher education. Those aren't going to be the elementary or high schools. Those are going to be your universities. And what you want to do is probably set up an appointment with the ornithologist at your closest university. There might not be an ornithologist, but there might be a biologist or vertebrate specialist. Just go in and ask or call and find out who that might be that would be the recipient of those specimens. But what you want to do first is make sure that you're covered on permits because you have to be permitted to hold and possess a wild bird or any part of a wild bird. And I deal with that a lot with our law enforcement, our game wardens. I'm having to ID things that people have in their possession. One of the more memorable ones was a young fellow got pulled over because hanging from his rearview mirror, he had the talons of a raptor. And I had to identify them. They were from a caracara in South Texas. So what you want to do is protect yourself. So get a relationship going with that biologist. See if they're permitted, state and federal permit, and they have what's called a salvage permit or a collecting permit, and see if you can get put under that as a sub-permittee, because you just want to protect yourself. So it's something you just don't want to advertise you're doing. And I hate to tell people to throw a bird away. Because I'm like you, I would, if it's something of value, and that's how we get a lot of really cool records, is roadkill. One of our very first and only state record of mottled owl from South Texas was a roadkill. So that's how you can get new things on your state list is with a dead bird. But you want to make sure that you're permitted for this. And the problem's not gonna, you know, the game warden's not gonna break your door down and say, I'm looking for something in your freezer. You just don't want to really stockpile birds in your freezer. Work it out with that biologist at the university and figure out a little system, and don't brag about it. Don't put it on your Facebook, hey, look at this bald eagle I picked up and I've got in my possession. That's just not smart. Just do what's right, but do it quietly and do it properly. And so get that relationship going with that biologist.
Now, in this area, does that also go for feathers and things like that?
Yes. And the feathers, even though they're not on the bird, you're in violation of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. I didn't write the act. It was in 1918. I'm not that old. So please don't kill the messenger. I'm just telling you the way it is. And so you cannot be in possession of feathers. And really the problem is going to be at flea markets. I often have to identify feathers that people have added into, say, a bouquet of something that they're selling, and they'll add a blue jay feather for color. And you just don't want to do that. You don't want to add parts of birds, of native birds. You can do it if it's a chicken or a pheasant or a game bird, but just don't do it with everything else. So blue jay is out of the question.
And that's interesting, because even if it's fallen off the bird already, then you can't literally, claim it. It's on the ground, it's lying there, but it's still Mother Nature's, basically.
Yes, and I should go back to the caracara that was dangling from the young fellow's rearview mirror in his car. He claimed that the bird was dead on the road, and it was too pretty to let it go or leave it, and he decided to cut the legs off, so the bird was already dead. Well, he can't prove that. He can't show that that happened. So the best rule of thumb is just don't pick it up. Now, the exception is going to be what I'm talking about. Well, this caller was a great question. This is the exception. If it's something valid or juicy, collect it. And actually, people in museums, they don't want to have a hit list of things they want, because all of a sudden that's when all of a sudden you don't get the good bird, because you just want to take everything in, because all of a sudden you're going to say, holy cow, that's a flame-elated owl, where the observer might have thought it's just another eastern screech owl, but it might be a new county record for flame-elated owl, which is a migratory owl that probably passes through this listening area that we don't know really anything about. But a roadkill record would probably shine light on it. The date would be important, the location, and then that biologist that would skin the bird would look to see, you know, is it healthy? Was it have a lot of fat on it? And that's really important for migratory birds, of course. So yeah, so in short, make sure you're protected with the permits.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can call in right now at 800-552-8502. Again, that is 800-552-8502 with your questions, anything relating to birds or our avian world. And we have Pete from Zavala, Texas. Pete, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hi. Well, I first got a comment. I called a few months ago.
Are you the macaw guy? Are you the parrot macaw guy?
Yes.
Yes. I remember that. I remember that call. That was great.
I finally have them. The macaw. Bert's bond, I guess, because lets me. I put on a pair of welding gloves at first.
So you caught them?
Yes.
Oh, can you?
I fed them, and no, they came into the house.
Whoa. Well, they were really tame.
So now I have a cockatoo and a green winged macaw.
Hey, all right.
He stalks around, he terrorizes the dogs, and he's a pretty neat bird, the macaw is.
Yeah. Now, I thought, if I recall, you had a hyacinth, or maybe was that, am I not thinking the same?
Yeah, I had a hyacinth. Personally.
Okay. But he wasn't one of the loose ones. That's right.
No.
Okay.
I just wanted to let you know that they've got a home.
Oh, that's great.
As can be.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Yeah, they didn't really need to be around out there. They sure wouldn't have liked last night, would they? It was, in the 20s in Zavala last night?
They've got their own bedroom. And
well, that's cool.
Yeah, I let them out, and they terrorized. They walked through the house. I did have a question. Well, actually, two questions. One, how often should a bird poop?
How often should a bird poop? Well, I don't know. I think a doctor would ask a human that, too.
I mean, is it like every 5 minutes, 10 minutes? Because these things go all the time.
Yeah, and they poo and pee all in one, so it's kind of runny. It's the color. You want to make sure it's got a little green and white tinge to it. Usually, let me think, maybe a green center and a white outer rim.
That's what it is?
Yeah.
It's like encapsulated.
Yeah, and I mean, if a bird is eating a lot, he's going to be pooping a lot. So that's a tough question to answer. I think it's not really the volume. It's more of the consistency and the color of it. So if it's super runny, that could be a problem. But if it's got some, it shouldn't have chunks, but it just should have a little bit of form, but it's still going to be like melted, almost like melted ice cream. I hate to use that analogy with poo, but hey, I don't know how else to do this on the fly like that. So, but no, I'm not a vet, but I have had parrots in the past, and they're really, the concern is that, you know, that their pooping is good, but it's not really the frequency. It's more the color and the consistency of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you the question. I'm the uppermost. Am I doing a disservice by feeding birds in the winter, by keeping feeders out?
Pete, that's a fantastic question. It's one that I toy with all the time. It's also the one that I tell people that's the best way to get started with bird watching. I mentioned earlier about going out to look at waterfowl. That means go in the car, drive to a pond. But the step before that is when you're in your pajamas sipping on coffee, it's so easy to look out your window at what's at your backyard feeder. So I really like to tell people to try that, to start off to look at birds that way. But I think what you have to remember is that it's supplemental. It's never sustenance. And so when people freak out that no one's coming to the feeder, they think all the birds are dead. No, they're not. You just have to remember that, guess what? 200 years ago, we were not feeding birds in this area, and birds did just fine. So I don't know what to tell you. I think it's a great thing to do for a lot of people. Now, the other caller that said that the hawk is camping out, that's another thing you got to worry about. If you don't like to see that part of Mother Nature where there's carnivorous birds that eat other birds, like the Cooper's hawk that's going to take your beautiful cardinal, then maybe feeding birds is not for you, because you might witness all that out your window while you're sipping coffee and that cardinal is eating seeds that you put out there. So I think it's just a personal judgment, and I go back and forth. I'll be honest, we do it in our backyard, but we don't do it year long. We don't do it in the summer months. The seeds get kind of sweaty, and I just worry about aflatoxin. It's a fungus that can grow on seeds. It's very deadly to birds when in high concentration, and it can be a big problem. Actually, we did have a kind of an outbreak of aflatoxin this year in the late summer. I don't remember the month in Texas, but we had several people calling with dead birds in the hotter months at the feeder, and we didn't test them, but normally one of the causes of death is aflatoxin, and that's not good to do to provide seed in the summer months. So just if you do it, just remember it's supplemental, it's not sustenance, and just enjoy it.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Pete. Say hi to the parrot for me.
Thanks for calling in, Pete. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and he will be with us for another 10 minutes. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. So really, our backyard bird feeders are sort of like the snack vending machine that you have on the way as you head out of work and you're going to get the real meal.
It's just not there for survival. That's what I mean by supplemental. It's sustenance is survival, and that's not what they need. That's not right. What these feeders are. I should mention about the last caller, if you didn't catch what we were talking about, maybe an inside joke, go to the podcast from the last episode, because he was one of the callers that talked about a free-flying macaw in his area in Zavala, and I thought that was a lot of fun. We had a really good time with that call. So you can, that's the beauty of the show. You can go back to the podcast and get caught up to speed, and it won't be an inside joke.
You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, and we have Kenny online from Shreveport. Kenny, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
I had your story about owls and roadkill reminded me of a story, because I have been commuting between Austin, Texas, and Shreveport for the past year and a half, and I've hit a couple of owls.
Okay.
The last one was remarkable because I was driving along. I like to drive at night. A bird swooped down into my headlights, and an owl was in pursuit, a large owl.
Mm-hmm.
And I hit the owl, and it occurred to me it may have been a setup of some kind, or just a lucky coincidence for the bird. But I stopped the car and looked for the owl, but there was tall grass, and I was not able to find it. But I really hated doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was coincidence. I think, it could have been another owl he was chasing.
The bird swooped right down into my headlights,
mm-hmm.
and the owl was in pursuit, and bam.
Yeah, and actually, we have to be careful when we do hit an owl. We can carry it in our grill for miles and states and countries apart. I mean, if you're a truck driver, you could hit something 2 days ago, and it's doing fine in your grill on a day, weather like this is going to keep chilled. They can get really stuck in the grill, so it's really difficult to then, when you do provide it to a university that wants it as a specimen, you got a tough time saying, well, what county was I in? But your case, you knew exactly when you did it. So what you could
look for it.
Yeah.
I have a good lantern now, but I didn't have a flashlight with me, or I would have found it.
Yeah, and
I really hated to do it.
But. Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. And owls, really, they just aren't that bright. Is that the right word? I mean, they're...
You know what Kurt Vonnegut said?
What's that?
They're a symbol of wisdom, but they're as stupid as chickens.
That's exactly right. And unfortunately, on the road's edge, they're on one side of the road. They have binocular forward-facing vision. That means the eyes are looking straight ahead. And they see something on the other side of the road, and they go over there to get it. They're low, and they don't see that vehicle coming. And so they get whacked. So they don't have time to get out of the way because they don't really have that good peripheral view. All the focus is on that rodent or whatever that food item is on the other side of the road. So you see a lot of barred owls, roadkill along creeks and rivers because that's the habitat they're in. You see in the wintertime a lot of barn owls dead along in areas where there's lots of prairie and grassland and other parts of the listening area, not right here where it's forest, so you don't have a lot of barn owls. So, but where I live, if you just go north a little bit, you have a lot of barn owls, and there are some winters where we just get a lot of them killed. And actually, one of the correlations is often with a drought year, and the fields are barren. Sometimes our roadways are very lush, and provide good habitat for the rodents. And that's what's the magnet for these owls. So it's unfortunate when the best habitat is along the roads and lures in the owls, and it's like building a playscape along the highway. You're eventually going to have a problem. And it's unfortunate, but there's nothing, I mean, what can we do? Are we going to shut down roads? No. There's nothing we can equip our cars to help with this? No. We have to either quit driving or drive slower and be alert, and that's difficult, but owls have to kind of pay attention too, but they're doing their job. So I don't know the answer to that. It's just a big problem, and it's probably getting worse for a lot of different owls.
And we want to thank everybody who called in tonight. We're going to wrap up tonight with another of our conservation moments. And this month, we're going to talk about going native. So can you explain what you mean by going native and how that can help our bird populations in this area?
Right. And by going native, we're talking about planting native plants in your yard. So there are many benefits to using native plants in your landscape. Think about it. Namely, they fit naturally with the soils and the climate of your area. You don't have to cover them up this time of the year, for example, like a lot of tropicals that are getting, they don't like this cold weather. But more importantly, with native habitat disappearing at an alarming rate, you can help provide birds and other wildlife with habitat they need. In his 2009 book, Bringing Nature Home, Doug Tallamy wrote that almost 63,000 square miles of land in the U.S. has been converted to lawns. Let me say that again. 63,000 square miles of the U.S. converted to lawns. So that's a big chunk of real estate. It actually equals about 8 times the size of New Jersey. So with that, and I'm talking about, think of your lawn, if it looks like a golf course with nice mowed grass, you can make a difference by dedicating part of it to natives. And what you can do is you can plant native plants in, if you're urban, suburban, or even rural, and you'll have these one or more of these 5 important benefits. So you'll provide cover, number one, cover for birds and other animals. That includes hiding and nesting and roosting. Roosting is another word for sleeping, by the way. Number two, you provide seeds, nuts, and fruits for birds and mammals. Number three, insects. You provide insects for birds, dragonflies, lizards, and toads. By the way, dragonflies are good neighbors to have. They eat a lot of mosquitoes. Number four, nectar for hummingbirds, butterflies, and moths. And number five, larval host plants for butterfly caterpillars. I'm thinking in this area of the pawpaw, which is the larval host plant for the zebra swallowtail, a great butterfly in our area. And guess what? These plants are native. They evolve naturally in our area. That means you don't need to spend all that money watering them, so you save money. It's good for the pocketbook. And lastly, I want to mention, prevent the introduction of invasive non-native plants. They're one of the top 3 reasons for steep declines in many of our birds. We have just changed a lot of the cover type. I'm thinking of Bermuda grass and the demise of bobwhite quail. So in summary, go native when you're planting plants. Provide habitat for the birds.
You have been listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and he is with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He is their non-game ornithologist. Cliff, I want to thank you again for joining us tonight for a wonderful show, and I want to thank everybody for calling in tonight. I'm Bill Beckett, and I was your producer for tonight's program. We had help from Renee Moran, Wally Derleth, and Henry Edwards, and the audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in a few hours, so you can always listen again to this show at redriverradio.org. Our next edition of Bird Calls will be on Tuesday, January 20th, 2015, and our next edition of What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden will be next month on Tuesday, December 16th. Bird Calls is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana and is produced in the studios of Red River Radio. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is next here on your community-supported public radio station, Red River Radio. We are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, Magnolia, and KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches.